Good morning and welcome to Studio 619. I'm Susan Sweeney Crum. Coming up, Kristen Espelon looks at the environmental relationship between shareholders and their companies. First, the word recession is on the tongues of economists around the country, but is America headed for one? That answer may very well be in the Beige Book, a quarterly report put out by the Federal Reserve. It's designed to show financial trends before they happen. This year's Beige Book shows an economic slowdown in Louisville. WFPL's Gabe Bullard talked to Regional Fed Director Howard Wall about the report.
For Louisville, we have that the overall pace of activity seems to have declined in recent months. And that comes from most of our contacts and the anecdotal information we have. And particularly, retail sales seem to have slowed down, along with car dealerships. Now, the importance of this is that this information is a bit different from formal data that come out on employment, which show that Louisville actually has been doing pretty well over the last few months. But those data can really be revised a lot, so we like to kind of balance it with both types of information.
So employment is up, but people are buying less?
Employment is up, but at least so the estimates of employment are up, and our survey says that retail sales are down. So there's a bit of a disjoint there, and that kind of leads us to think, well, why don't we look at everything overall and see how things are.
How much is employment, are employment estimates up, and how much is buying down?
Well, for the year of 2007, Louisville employment is estimated to be up by 6,900, which is 1.1%. Now, to put that in perspective, the national average was 0.8%. So Louisville employment growth was substantially faster than U.S. growth, according to those estimates. Now, on the other hand, on the retail side, of the retailers we surveyed, two-thirds of them said that sales were down compared with the same 2 months of last year. So the months don't exactly match up, but still they're painting a slightly different picture, or radically different pictures of the Louisville economy.
Is this odd that employment would be up? I mean, in other cities, could employment ever be up while purchasing is down?
Well, it's a bit odd. So one of the two estimates is off, or maybe they're both off, and it's somewhere in between. But I think the overall story we get out of this is that Louisville is probably not doing as bad as some other places, but probably not as good as the estimates of employment indicate.
Now, when you say estimate, some people might think it sounds like unscientific data gathering on your side, but how do you come about with these estimates?
Well, the employment estimates are provided by the Bureau of Labor Statistics, so that's not us. So what they do is they survey maybe thousands of businesses, well, hundreds of thousands of businesses in the country, and then they give employment estimates based on this survey, because they don't survey every single business, so they don't really know exactly how many jobs were created. So they have to then extrapolate from the survey that they do to what the total is. And that's kind of where the trick is, you know, you have to know how many firms there are, and that is not always known with precision. So that's why you can get these sort of statistical errors that then get corrected later on.
And how do you come about with the buying estimates?
This is a survey, a phone survey that we do as part of our regular process of gathering information for the Beige Book, which is more for monetary policy. So we call up contacts that are retailers and just ask them how they're doing, and we keep it kind of open-ended to let them tell us something. So we don't talk to as many people as, we don't talk to all the businesses, but we also think it's usually pretty accurate, at least in telling the direction of changes.
Now, unemployment and employment is measured typically by people who don't have jobs but are looking for jobs, correct?
Right. So if you're unemployed, that means that you're looking for a job. You're in the labor market and looking for a job. So people who aren't looking are not counted as being in the labor force at all.
So could that possibly explain why it looks like employment rates have gone up in Louisville?
No, because the employment tells you exact people who actually have jobs, because this is a survey of firms, and they say, okay, how many people do you have on your payrolls?
So the amount of people on payrolls have gone up.
Right. Well, the estimate of it.
All right. And with buying being down, is that a sign of any sort of bad economic state in the area or the nation?
Yes, I think it is, because what's been keeping the economy afloat when there are all sorts of things buffeting it over the last few years was consumer spending. You know, consumers still kept spending through all of the, you know, crises and mini-crises that occurred, and kind of relying on that to bolster the economy. And if, you know, sales of to consumers is decreasing, then maybe this is a harbinger of something worse to come.
Like a recession?
Right.
So would you say people are afraid to be spending?
Well, that's the alternative, that it's not really that it's a recession, but that people are just a bit afraid because there's a lot of uncertainty out there about how things are going to pan out with financial markets, housing markets, and so on. So it could just be holding back for the time being until things settle down a bit and they get a better idea about how things are going to be in the future.
But couldn't that, if people just aren't spending, could that lead to a recession?
Yes, it's all circular. It all works together, which is why, you know, I guess we like, in some ways, for confidence to be up, so that you know people will spend, and then therefore the confidence ends up coming through.
How could confidence be restored?
Well, I can give you an example for the Fed. What we've been doing lately is, you know, helping out to stabilize financial markets by stepping in and, you know, using our role as a lender of last resort to and expanding that role to bolster the financial system so that, you know, this signals that, you know, we're very serious that we're not going to let the financial system collapse, and we're very serious about, you know, keeping an eye on the economy by lowering rates and so on. So I guess our message is that, you know, we're ready to act and we are doing it. So that the financial sector will be will survive all of this. And that's a very important aspect of the economy.
Couldn't extra lending cause more problems down the road?
Well, the extra lending mostly could cause inflationary problems. If you loosen money supply, then you can get higher inflation. And that's our dual mandate, is to keep inflation in check and growth high. And we're always balancing those two things. But, you know, we're still keeping an eye on inflation, but still what the Open Market Committee seems to feel now is that the risks are more towards a downturn on the economic side, the real side, rather than the inflation side.
Is there a risk of, you hear it talked about a lot, stagflation in the area with buying down and possibly inflation going up?
Well, that's a risk, but I think a lot of that is mistaken because people look at the increases in their daily commodities that they buy. A lot of food prices have gone up. Gas prices obviously have gone up. And this really isn't inflation in the sense that there's too much money in the system. It means that the prices of a bunch of things are rising, that, you know, important things. But that's different from inflation where, you know, there's just too much money chasing too few goods. And that is very difficult to control. So that's different. So people are thinking, well, I see these items going up, so that's inflation. And I see, you know, spending going down, so maybe stagflation or, you know, kind of two big problems. But really, I think it's a misreading of what inflation means in terms of this.
If people are spending more on items like food and gasoline, mm-hmm. could they just be saving or not having the money to buy other things? And could that make spending be lower?
That's certainly part of it, is that you can, because you're spending more on some things, you don't have as much available to you know, to buy, you know, other things that you otherwise would have, or you put off getting your you know, your car serviced because, you know, that oil change is put off a few weeks, you know, because you have to pay more for gas and so on. Or it could be that you don't have as much money coming in, but it's difficult at this stage to figure out which exactly of those things is dominant.
So you don't know if wages are down?
We don't really know if wages are down, no.
So what could be done? You mentioned on a federal level. What could private entities, local government, or citizens do?
Well, I think that what's going on now is really national. It's based in the housing markets and the financial markets. And although housing markets are very local, it's the local housing markets are being affected by national financial market problems, so that financing for housing is getting more difficult to get. So that affects local housing markets. So I think the thing for local governments, state and local governments, to do is, I suppose, to if anything, just kind of make the housing market work as well as it can, because that's really where the local economy is being affected most.
How does Louisville compare to some other cities?
In which regard?
In buying, being down, employment rates, et cetera.
It seems to be pretty similar in terms of the retail sales, at least of the ones in our district. We have very similar results from our survey everywhere. But the estimates of employment have it being stronger than other places.
And what is the Beige Book used for?
Well, the Beige Book is used for trying to get ahead of the data, because official government data might come 2-3 months after the fact. But the FOMC needs to act right now and on the future. So the Fed has an array of contacts all around the country, and they collect information from them to give us a better idea about what the data is going to be when it does come out, because we have to know what's going on right now, not what happened 3 months ago.
What do you mean, FOMC?
Sorry, the Federal Open Market Committee.
Oh, okay. FOMC, sorry, I misspoke there. So do you think we're heading for a recession?
I don't know. I think it might become clear in the next few weeks to see how financial markets react to what the Fed has done already, and see if there are any sort of new surprises coming down, because there are other problems, that maybe other banks will have problems and the Fed will have to step in again, or maybe we've restored confidence and we won't need to. But the next probably month or two is really a time to keep an eye on things.
How do you restore confidence?
Well, just by stepping in and doing sensible things, not getting too panicky, but being there and really serving as the lender of last resort, to know that the banking system and the financial system is not going to have a panic like there was in the Great Depression and so on, and that with confidence in the financial system, then people can go on and have greater confidence in buying houses and getting loans and all of that.
So this doesn't compare to any of the panics of the past, you're saying?
No. One of the big differences is that we're much better equipped to deal with them than we were in the past. Although some of the aspects of this are very different, and we're having to kind of be very creative in some of the things that we do.
Like what?
Well, the recent things where they've included more firms, financial firms, as who we can lend to, because it used to be just, the definition of a bank has really changed since the laws were put in place. So this past week, really what happened was that the Fed expanded the definition of a bank in some way, so that these large dealers in New York are now eligible to borrow from the Fed in order to meet their short-term requirements. Whereas in the past, it was really more strictly banks that could do this. But we've really expanded this lending facility that we have.
Firms like Bear Stearns?
Right. So in the past, they would have been just strictly dealers on Wall Street and all of that, but not really a bank. But now they're part bank, part old-style financial firm. So we really expanded the type of firms we were going to serve by being their lender of last resort, too.
That was WFPL's Gabe Bullard speaking with Regional Federal Reserve Director Howard Wall. Mr. Wall's Fed branch is located in St. Louis. When we come back, more on the television switch from analog to digital. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Susan Sweeney Crum. Shareholders are using their leverage to persuade companies to address climate change in record numbers. WFPL's Kristen Espeland reports.
Publicly traded companies hold annual meetings not only to discuss their performance, but also to ask shareholders to vote on company business. Often, that business includes proposals or resolutions from shareholders themselves, calling on a company to change certain practices or address an issue. This year, shareholders filed a record 54 resolutions asking companies to respond to climate change, some of which may come up for a vote at annual meetings this spring. One of those comes from the Louisville-based headquarters of the Presbyterian Church of the United States. Reverend Bill Simplatsky-German oversees the organization's nearly $2 billion in assets under management. He says he hopes their shares in ConocoPhillips will sway the energy giant to do more to reduce greenhouse gas emissions.
Our goal is to work with a company to help them see the benefit of it being forthright in addressing global climate change. And we've had success with other companies in doing that, and we were hoping that ConocoPhillips would have a similar response.
But Simplatsky-German says company executives have declined to meet with him to discuss the proposal. The resolution asks ConocoPhillips first to adopt specific goals for reducing greenhouse gas emissions from their products and operations. But Simplatsky-German wants the company to look even further ahead.
And then to begin planning for what are the implications for them as a fossil fuel-based company, basically, for living in a carbon-constrained world. Which is going to come about as we try to address climate change.
Trillium Asset Management also has a pending environmental resolution with ConocoPhillips, but the ability to win a majority of shareholder votes on this and the Presbyterian Church's resolution is uncertain. Shareholders voted down two environmental resolutions on the ballot last year. Still, Rob Barrage with the Socially Responsible Investors Coalition called Ceres says this shareholder activism isn't just about curbing global warming, it's about ensuring a steady, profitable return. Barrage gives this example.
If you're a coal company and you're not preparing for the transition to a low carbon economy, investors have reason to worry about, you know, the long-term prospects for your business.
His organization oversees the Investor Network on Climate Change. It tries to help investors and businesses get a handle on the financial risks and opportunities climate change creates. The network's 60 major investors manage more than a whopping $5 trillion in assets collectively. But are resolutions really making any verifiable difference? Rob Barrage cites the electric power industry. Investors filed several resolutions with electric companies, and some, he says, have already been agreed to without going up for a vote.
The investors this year asked the companies to report on how the companies are working with the people who regulate the electric utilities to allow the utility to implement energy efficiency programs and to allow the utility to get paid to do that work, so that the shareholders of the utility can get rewarded even if the utility is selling less power.
Barrage says most resolutions this year have to do either with getting companies to set quantifiable goals for reducing emissions or to disclose the financial risks they face because of climate change. And he says there's an ongoing discussion with the Securities and Exchange Commission to require that kind of disclosure. For WFPL, I'm Kristen Espeland.
Shareholders may be able to use activism to get the companies they invest in to change the way they do business, but activism is no match for the fragile stock market and a likely recession. To learn more about how Louisville might weather a recession, Kristen Espeland spoke with PNC Financial Services Group's chief economist, Stuart Hoffman. Hoffman says Louisville may be starting off in a better place than most.
Recently, the Louisville area has been growing jobs, outgrowing Cincinnati, Indianapolis, maybe not Chicago, certainly outgrowing Pittsburgh and Cleveland, Buffalo. It's hard to say exactly why. The area has a fairly well-diversified industrial base. Professional services have been growing. Healthcare has been growing. You've had the UPS, which has had a tremendous growth and added jobs to the region. Some of the weak spots are in the auto sector. The Ford plants here are scaling back as auto sales in general are declining, reflecting of a weak economy. So the Louisville economy is relatively better off, although all the data we look at in terms of home prices, in terms of jobs, have slowed down quite a bit over the course of 2007, and frankly are looking pretty flat at best as we go through 2008.
Another big indicator and a huge story across the country, of course, housing and foreclosures, the subprime mortgage loan debacle. We've had foreclosures, but they've actually declined recently. What might have insulated Louisville from some of the drama?
Well, Louisville, like many other cities in around the Midwest, avoided the boom, and now you're avoiding the bust. When you look back to 04 and 05, house prices were rising in Louisville around 5%, according to these national numbers, at the time when the national average house price was up 10, 12, 13%, and as we know in some regions in California and Florida, 20 and 25% increases were not uncommon. There was a huge investor interest, a lot of people investing in those other areas, thinking they were going to, you know, flip that house. That did not happen that much in Louisville. The same thing with the subprime issue and the voluminous problems it's causing, fortunately, was pretty much bypassed here in this region. So now that the worm has turned and house prices nationwide were down around 8% by one measure last year and double digit in places like Miami and Tampa and Naples and Southern California and, frankly, in Michigan, although more because of the weak economy, Louisville doesn't have that problem. You don't have a lot of investors sitting there thinking they were going to make a killing only to find out the only one getting killed was themselves or their banks. You don't have a lot of people who took a lot of subprime loans and are now facing the foreclosure. You didn't have a lot of builders building spec houses on the hope and anticipation that, you know, they were going to make a lot of money between the time they broke ground and the time they closed. So like Pittsburgh, like Cincinnati, like to some extent Columbus, Ohio, this region missed the bust, missed the boom, and therefore doesn't have that house of cards, literally and figuratively, falling down on your region now. And I'm not saying I don't think housing activity won't be down in Louisville. Housing probably will be down. Home sales, home construction, it'll be a weak period. Indeed, they were down. Home construction was down in 07. But the decline is going to be more moderate. And in an affordable housing market, we'll probably be better able to cope with that than in many other cities more on the east and west coast that had the boom and now are living through the bust.
I wanted to also ask you just a bit about some of the other national stories we've been hearing about. Of course, the Federal Reserve Bank has been cutting rates right and left, and we may see another rate cut, as I understand it. What might be some of the effects of these repeated cuts?
And the Fed has been very aggressive. I've been in this business. I used to work at the Federal Reserve back in the 1970s when I got my career started, and I've been watching the Fed now for 30 years, and this is the most aggressive I've seen them cut interest rates, given that they weren't that high to begin with. In the last 6 months, they've cut the rate over which they have the most control by 3.25%. They've also done other things that are fairly novel and new to the Fed to try to provide liquidity, to provide cash, for lack of a better term, to a lot of the banks and brokerage firms and others who are really needing cash, including some municipal entities that have had problems. So I always think of the Fed funds rate, the rate that you're referring to that the Fed cut, is like the sledgehammer of monetary policy. But they also have to operate with more precision. What effects will it have in Louisville? Not any in particular, but what effects I think it will have in the U.S. economy is I think it will help lift consumer spending and business investment and economic activity in the second half of this year. The U.S. economy is in a recession. That's my humble opinion. There's no official recognition. And I think we'll have what I call a short and shallow recession or downturn, lasting probably another 3 or 4 months. And let's not forget all those big rebate checks, $110 to $115 billion, that are actually going to start showing up in people's mailboxes in early May through July. There's a lot of stimulus, both Fed stimulus and government stimulus, in the pipeline. And that's why I think both regional, like Louisville, and the national economy will turn around and show modest economic growth.
the upturn you talk about as a result of a lot of the stimulus, is it possible that we could already be seeing a little bit of that? I mean, the Fed report for the 8th District here mentioned that some of their contacts at, you know, banks and in the finance world said that housing loans, consumer loans, were actually pretty steady. People are being encouraged to take advantage of the low interest rates right now. So could we be seeing a little bit of a silver lining?
That could be the very beginnings or inklings of that improvement. I don't think I want to put too much stock in a couple of weeks' worth of data. Mortgage rates have fallen. They're probably going to fall somewhat further. I think housing is going to continue to go down, and there'll be some pressure on home prices and home sales in the Louisville region and across the nation this spring and summer. Maybe we'll see more concrete signs of improvement in this region in the fall. But frankly, nationwide, I don't think it'll be till the spring of 2009 before you really see any really good signs that the housing market has hit bottom and is maybe poised for some sort of an improvement.
Stuart Hoffman is chief economist for PNC Financial Services Group based in Pittsburgh.
The genocide in Sudan's Darfur region has moved some Kentucky lawmakers to draft legislation encouraging Kentucky to stop investing in foreign companies that do business in that country. WFPL's Elizabeth Kramer has more.
Tom Reiner has a short answer for why he introduced House Bill 703 during this year's General Assembly.
Moral outrage at the genocide that's being sponsored by the Sudan government.
Reiner represents Louisville in Kentucky's House of Representatives and became interested in Darfur after a Sudanese refugee spoke about it at a local church. That motivated Reiner to co-sponsor a bill last year with other legislators prohibiting many state pension funds from investing in foreign companies with ties to Sudan. U.S. sanctions ban most American companies from doing business there. After the bill failed to pass, Reiner and some colleagues modified their approach. The current bill covers just the State Investment Commission and the pension fund for Kentucky judges and legislators. It also only recommends that investments not include specific companies named by human rights organizations because they invest in Sudan's oil sector and benefit its military. Similar legislation has become law in 24 states. Local activists seeking an end to the genocide in Darfur back the bill and are aligned with the Sudan Divestment Task Force based in Washington, D.C. It estimates that U.S. investments that benefit Sudan total in the hundreds of millions of dollars. Adam Sterling is the organization's director.
We put a lot of time and energy into finding the good guys and the bad guys, and we ensure that the bad guys are the ones that ultimately face divestment from these binding legislations.
Targeting international investments to achieve human rights agendas doesn't sit well with William Reinch of the National Foreign Trade Council. He says these divestment laws lose money for investors and are ineffective.
They don't achieve their intended objectives unless you define their objective as making us feel better. But it doesn't achieve the objective of changing the behavior of the target country.
Using divestments as foreign policy tools gained credibility in the 1980s after a host of universities and municipalities employed them against companies working in South Africa. Groups backing laws supporting divestment in Sudan cite that experience as a precedent. Others argue South Africa was a partially democratic government and beholden to public opinion, which holds little sway with Sudan's authoritarian regime. Advocates for these laws also say they aren't just aimed at Sudan, but Chinese companies that have made large investments in the country. For example, the China National Petroleum Corporation has invested at least $5 billion in Sudan. Bennett Friedman is a senior vice president for social research and policy for the Calvert Investment Firm. He supports these laws.
Where it's been most helpful is in getting the message to some of the oil companies that are based in China in particular, and getting the message to the Chinese government.
Representative Tom Reiner says the House bill specifically mentions China.
That one nation alone could turn everything around in the Sudan.
The bill, which the House passed last week, is non-binding. Reiner and others are working to persuade the Senate to pass it as a binding resolution. For WFPL, I'm Elizabeth Kramer.
One year from now, all television broadcasts in the United States will be digital. Across Kentucky, thousands of television viewers will need to get new equipment to keep receiving over-the-air transmissions. WFPL's Gabe Bullard has more.
show him a newer set of digital tuner.
Daryl Harlow and the crew at Clarksdale TV Repair have pulled the back off of a plasma screen television set, and they're pointing to a small silver box wired into it.
There's a digital tuner.
Is it mounted to that board right there?
That box is how any TV made in the last year gets picture information from over-the-air signals. In a year, it'll be the only way to get over-the-air signals.
In 2005, Congress mandated that all television broadcast facilities would make the transition from analog broadcasting to digital broadcasting. The date for this transition is February 17, 2009.
Television networks have been running ads about a change in broadcasting. After February 17th of next year, all TV signals will be digital. For cable or satellite users, nothing will change. But regular television antennas won't be able to interpret the information.
There is the possibility that I will go and buy a digital TV and not even worry about not being able to get the broadcast signals.
Lee Birchfield uses an analog television and a traditional antenna.
I have the old-fashioned kind that really is rabbit ears with the two metal antennas and then the metal loop in the center.
He thinks he'll buy a new TV for next year, but he doesn't have to. Nobody has to buy a new TV to get the digital signals. All you need to do is get a converter box, which costs between $40 and $60. The FCC even offers a coupon for $40 off converter boxes, so the total to pay to get the new signals is dramatically less than buying a digital TV. But Daryl Harlow, back at Clarksdale TV, says there's a drawback to keeping your old television.
You won't be watching a high-definition picture. It'll just convert it so that you can still watch your old picture.
The new digital signals will be high-definition, but if you're using a converter box, you won't get the HD picture. You will get a clearer picture. Since digital signals are all or nothing, the picture either comes in perfectly without snow or static, or it doesn't come in at all. Harlow says that's a problem in his shop.
We've tried on a television in this downtown area with an antenna, but this is a bad area because you're down right in the middle of downtown. You have to have an antenna up on a mast or something to get a good picture.
Digital signals are more likely to be blocked by buildings and trees, so antennas will have to be placed on roofs or towers to get the best reception in urban areas, which is where most non-cable or satellite viewers in Kentucky are.
Urban areas often have higher over-the-air percentages than rural areas. In rural areas, a lot of viewers have gone to satellite.
Tim Bischoff is leading KET's efforts to tell people about the digital switchover. He says KET reaches almost all of Kentucky households, and of those, about 15% of urban viewers get the signals over the air.
In urban areas, sometimes you have more channel choices over the air, and so that makes it a more attractive alternative than a pay delivery system.
And if urban viewers can pick up the digital signal, their channel choice will improve. Digital TV lets stations broadcast multiple channels on the same bandwidth. KET currently puts out 5 digital viewing options. But to get those, you'll need a digital TV, not a converter box.
This is a digital cable box, okay? This is high-definition channels here.
Harlow says it comes down to paying for TV. With a coupon, you can get a low-priced or possibly free converter at the local electronics store and keep watching TV on an analog set. If you pay the equivalent of a year or so of cable for a new TV, you'll get more channels over the air, and you'll see them in HD.
See, you see every freckle in his face, and you can see all the detail.
Or you can pay for cable or satellite and experience no change next February. For WFPL, I'm Gabe Bullard.
When we come back, Robin Fisher talks to Lexington author David King. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Susan Sweeney Crum. In the fall of 1814, every minor and major member of the European nobility descended on Vienna, Austria, for a peace congress designed to realign Europe after the downfall of Napoleon. Instead of a 2 to 3 week peace conference, it turned into a months-long party that would have a lasting effect on all of Europe. Robin Fisher spoke with author David King about this history-changing event and his new book, Vienna 1814, How the Conquerors of Napoleon Made Love, War, and Peace at the Congress of Vienna.
I have to ask you, I have to start with the actual writing of the book. I am a fiction reader, and I could not put your book down. And, I mean, how do you make a history book with a cast of thousands so conversational?
Oh, wow. Well, first, thank you very much. Yeah, it was a fun story, and I think I think the story really helped, because I think if I were to try to write this as fiction, I think my editor would sit down with me and say, no, you can't do this. There's no way you can do this because no one's going to believe it, because a lot of the events do seem almost too outrageous to be true. But in the case of the Congress of Vienna, that's the case. You often have that. It is almost too outrageous to be true, except that it is true. I was just always fascinated with the characters. I just tried to figure out what it would be like to be in Vienna in 1814, not knowing what's going to happen, just throwing yourself right in the middle and try to see what it would be like to be in the salons, in the middle of the ballrooms where a lot of the events took place.
How much research did you do for the book? Was it years of research, or are you able to focus intensely on one particular subject for a shorter amount of time?
Oh, yeah, it was years. I used to teach history at the University of Kentucky, and then when I started writing this book, I decided I was just going to do this full time because I wanted to throw myself right into the middle of this, just total immersion as much as I can. And so I wanted to read everything. I wanted to read everything I could get a hold of, some memoirs and diaries, letters, a lot of love letters, it turned out. I was able to come across some sources that, for some reason, had never been used. So I was very fortunate in that respect. And the source material was great. Like there are all these like spy reports. That's probably my favorite of all the sources, because the Austrian police had hired all these people to go through and follow the main people around town, see who they're talking to, where they're going, who they're eating dinner with, who they're sleeping with, if they could find out, eavesdropping in the conversations in the salons, and basically even infiltrating the embassies themselves. And some of the best spies were the chambermaids, who go through the wastebaskets and go through the fireplaces and the stoves for papers to reassemble.
Well, things don't really change, do they?
That's right. So this was a wonderful source, and it turns out all that had been destroyed. Actually, all these spy reports had been destroyed in the 20th century. But I found a couple of historians who had printed the archives about 100 years ago. One wrote in French, one wrote in German, never been translated. And this was wonderful for helping recreate this daily life of the Congress of Vienna.
Well, set the scene for us. What was Europe like in the fall of 1814?
Oh, yeah. It was Vienna was, you could probably say, the place to be, because you have the kings and queens and a couple emperors and many, many princes and princesses all coming to Vienna. Everyone a novel, one of the main characters would say. And I say in the book, there probably had never been more royalty in the same place at the same time ever in history, and staying under the same roof of the palace. And of course, they end up bickering over everything, big and small. And so it's they come there to celebrate, and it's the first real peace in over 20 years. So they do have a lot to celebrate, but the celebration tends to get out of control, and the conference takes a lot longer than they thought. They thought they'd be done in 3, 4, 5, maybe 6 weeks. It takes about 9 months.
And this was right after the fall of Napoleon?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, so Napoleon's empire was in ruins, and he had been a good kingmaker. He put members of his families on thrones all over the continent. So they had people in Vienna had a lot of work to do, try to redraw the maps, reestablish peaceful relations.
They weren't really redrawing the maps just from Napoleon, but they were also still sort of in flux after the decline of the Holy Roman Empire. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. Because Napoleon had ended that in 1806 after 1,000 years, after 1,000 year presence, Napoleon had removed it. And there are actually some Austrians and other aristocrats there hoping to revive the Holy Roman Empire and petitioning the Austrians to go for that. But the Austrians aren't interested. They figure it's more trouble than it's worth. I mean, there are a lot of limitations on power and a lot of changes in the way the selection of the emperor, who was voted, by the way. A lot of those changes would mean that the Austrians could lose control of the Holy Roman Empire, so they weren't interested in reviving it. So they just kind of pushed that to the side. But yeah, there's a lot of work to do. I mean, a lot of art to be restored. Vienna Congress is actually the first peace conference in history to address humanitarian issues as well. So you have a lot of Jewish rights, the slave trade, copyrights are on the agenda. So a lot of things. And, of course, they can't agree on anything.
Well, why was Vienna chosen?
Oh, that's a good question. When they got to Vienna, people wondered as well. They're like, well, this probably wasn't the best place because it turns into such a playground And some people say, well, there was even a rumor at the time in the spy reports that they're actually going to change and go to Berlin instead. Or and Prince Metternich, the Austrian foreign minister, is actually trying to move it to a spa town because, again, Vienna's too big. He said there's too many distractions, and he wants to kind of basically take over the proceedings and lock everybody out anyway, just have a few people make all the decisions. But the reason they chose Vienna, it seems it was really the Tsar, Alexander I, the Tsar of Russia, who is the Tsar in War and Peace, you may remember. He basically, in honor of the Austrian sacrifices, and Austria had fought Napoleon longer than any other power except for Britain. And Austria had suffered a lot. They were even bankrupt a few years ago, 1811. The currency lost 80% of its value, so they were struggling financially. And yet they're going to throw this party worthy of the Allied victory. So people wondered why Austria, one of the weaker of the great powers, was selected. But Austria jumped at the chance when the Tsar proposed it. And before he changed his mind, they agreed.
One thing I think is interesting, you just mentioned celebrating the Allied victory, but France, who you would think would be sort of considered the vanquished enemy, was very much a part of these talks.
Yes, that's right, and that was not by choice from the Allied leaders, because you're right, you know, France, a defeated power. Again, Napoleon was gone. Napoleon was already on the island of Elba, but still, you know, France, and they had the King Louis XVIII restored, but France, again, was blamed. To blame for the war, and losers in the war as well. And so they have a hard time when they arrive. But fortunately for them, they have a pretty mesmerizing delegate, Prince Talleyrand, who is just, he looks like he just stepped straight out of an 18th century salon. I mean, it's Talleyrand who helped mastermind Napoleon's seizure of power. It was also Talleyrand who helped plot Napoleon's downfall. So Talleyrand is this really dangerous character. In a lot of ways, he's extremely good at what he does, but you have to be careful with him. And so they try to block him out, but he ends up within a few months finding himself in a very good position of deciding, because the Allies can't agree on anything. So he gets into a position where everybody's trying to get France to join their side.
You have this one scene in the book where Talleyrand is getting dressed in the morning, and it is quite a production.
Yeah, he was quite a showman. I mean, this was a long, you know, couple hour process, not hurried, and people would be coming in, and he would, you know, talking to whatever's on their mind, and yeah, it was a good show. I mean, people would describe it in great detail because it stood out. I mean, he was a living legend, the Prince of Diplomats, he's called at the time, and people want to see him.
So every minor and major person of noble bearing was at the Congress, and they sort of jostled around to play parts. First it was sort of the big four, and then it became the big eight. But then somehow this descended into some sort of peace bacchanal. How did that happen?
Yeah, it was quickly losing control over the situation. Again, Metternich was Prince Metternich, the Austrian foreign minister, just real sophisticated and charming and very vain figure. I mean, he saw himself as a personally conquering Napoleon. He also saw himself as the greatest lover in the world. But he saw himself as, you know, he was trying to, you know, he was actually president of the Congress. And he was trying to control the situation so Austria and the great powers could decide everything. And Talleyrand is showing up. Again, there's great rivalry between the two, and appealing to everybody else that was left out. And again, no one counted all the people that came to Vienna. No one knows how many people came. I mean, the invitation was sent in the newspaper. So people just came. I mean, just, I have an estimate in the book, but it's just an educated guess based on tradition, really, as I say. But, I mean, it's just all these people are in town. And people are listening to him. And so here he is, the guy who represented a country that conquered them, is now the person they're appealing to as their best hope for you know, rescuing this peace, which people are saying is just, they're making a mockery of, as it gets very, very exclusive.
Well, do you think that they would have had a better job staying on task if they had left the women at home?
Oh, you know, that's one of the great things about the Congress of Vienna, is that the women are extremely important to the Congress. And I say that there's never been a peace conference in history where women have had a more influential role. And they are, I think that it makes the story so much better, so much more interesting because of the women that are there. The Duchess of Sagan, for example, is she breaks Metternich's heart. Again, this the great lover ends up getting his heart broken. It's at a time when, you know, the Congress and Austria really need his attentions. And he's just, you know, he's writing love letters in middle meetings. I found some of those. And it's, yeah, he's just really close to a breakdown. Talleyrand's also in love. That's not 100% sure, but very, very likely. And it's definitely the case by the end of the Congress, definitely by then. And it's with a 21-year-old hostess, actually the Duchess of Sagan's younger sister. And there's another lady, Bagration, Princess Bagration, who's the arch-rival of the Duchess of Sagan and also just, I mean, also a former lover of Metternich's and the Tsars. And so it makes it so much more interesting. And the salons actually is where a lot of the diplomacy takes place. So I think that, and they also really help help a lot of things go forward. But, of course, you're right. They are blamed for a lot of things. When things aren't going well, some people blame the women because they're saying they're controlling these men like puppets or marionettes.
So they're going along, and they're practicing a little peace, and they're having a lot of fun. And then in March 1815, something unexpected happens.
that's right. This is, yeah, they celebrating the victory of Napoleon, and then all of a sudden, you know, Metternich's woken up in the middle of the night with an urgent letter. He puts it to the side because, you know, here's another urgent letter. I'll deal with that later. And Napoleon has left the tiny island of Elba. And he's back, or he's on his way back. They don't know where he's going yet. But it's really amazing. It's like one of the good things about this is you really see Napoleon at one of the most exciting periods of his very exciting career. Is he leaves the tiny island of Elba. He has roughly 1,100 men, four cannons, count them, four cannons, and he's taken on one of the most powerful countries in the world, France. He says, I'll be back without firing a shot. And to everyone's amazement, he does return. So all of a sudden, the Congress, they have to get together and go defeat Napoleon again. So it's, I mean, it's one of these key events in a lot of people's lives, as I say in the memoirs. Everyone remembers where they were when they found out, well, Napoleon, you know, the letter said, where's Napoleon? Has anybody seen Napoleon?
Well, one thing I thought was interesting is that both Metternich and then Talleyrand, when he got the letter, neither one of them looked, they assumed it wasn't, whatever it was not that important. Neither one of them ripped the letter open to read it. And then to find out that it's about Napoleon leaving Elba was shocking.
Yeah, that's exactly. I mean, Talleyrand is there, and he's with his hostess Dorothy, and you know she's sitting beside the bed, and she opens it and says, "You know, what about my rehearsal? Because there's a play rehearsal later that evening for a production that she's in." He's like, "Oh, don't worry, it'll take place all the same." Talleyrand was very good at. Even if he happened to be panicked, he was very good at looking very reserved. One person said you could kick him 20 times in the backside, and he would never move a muscle in his face. I mean, he was just a classic poker face. And later on, some people are saying, well, you know, Talleyrand is looking a little uncomfortable. And another thing, too, Talleyrand, after finding himself in the center of everything, he now found himself, when Napoleon escaped, outside again. Because people were, you know, France is all of a sudden going to be an enemy.
Well, David, thank you very much for your time today.
Oh, thank you. This is my pleasure.
That was WFPL's Robin Fisher talking with David King, author of Vienna 1814, How the Conquerors of Napoleon Made Love, War, and Peace at the Congress of Vienna. King will be reading from his latest book and signing copies Tuesday evening at 7 at Joseph Beth Booksellers in Lexington. You can learn more about today's show or start an online conversation on our blog online at WFPL.org. You can also email us from there or listen to previous broadcasts in our audio archive. You can also write to us at Studio 619, 619 South 4th Street, Louisville, Kentucky, 40202. Or you can reach us by phone at 814-6500. Studio 619 is produced by Louisville Public Media. Everything you hear on Studio 619 is compiled by the staff at LPM, including WFPL, WFPK, and WUOL. We also air submissions from Kentucky Public Radio, a collaboration of all the public radio stations in the Commonwealth. I'm Susan Sweeney Crum. Join us next time for another edition of Studio 619 on WFPL.